From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, so I know I'm right before lunch. We are right before lunch. I promise you, we will keep this concise and we will definitely wrap up at 1:30 on the dot for lunch. So please do not worry. Just, just for the next half an hour, let's, enjoy what the panelists have to share about the Islamic investment space. I will waste no time. I'll perhaps, you know what, Elias, I'm going to get you to start, right? So the entire morning, I will be brief. Since the whole day, in the whole entire morning, there was so much discussion on taxonomies, as well as we learn how vital it is, but also how fluid it is. And there's also, we talk about the importance of a robust regulatory frameworks, right? So I'm curious to know, how do you think this would evolve?
Thank you very much, Vinita. And I will try and keep it brief. There is so much to be said about taxonomies, how they're impacting products, especially in the Islamic finance space, and how those products will continue to evolve. So I think, the panel before us, and indeed actually throughout the morning, have spoken around the developments in taxonomies across the EU, across Southeast Asia, in Malaysia as well. So we've got the EU taxonomy, the potential greenness of a project or a given investment strategy is determined based on sustainability criteria and the strategy's objectives. So you're required to meet at least one of the sustainability criteria while doing no significant harm to the other sets of criteria effectively. Closer to home, we have the SRI taxonomy here in Malaysia, and we've heard a lot about that today, rightly so. That taxonomy aims to give clarity towards enabling proper and consistent identification and classification of the various types of economic activities that would fit within the sustainability criteria or umbrella. So what's in that context, I think you're asking, what is a Sharia-compliant product or investment? So I think, simply put, it's an investment that doesn't hit any of the prohibitions. So it complies with prohibitions against a number of different activities. But increasingly, there's also an ethical screening that's applied to these products. So it goes beyond the prohibitions. Increasingly, it is a product that complies with the various values that are encouraged under Sharia. And then overlaid onto that, you have the various ESG or sustainability taxonomies and metrics. What's interesting to note is that actually the values and the ethical screening aspect that you find from the Sharia compliance perspective align very, very closely with what is provided for in the taxonomies. So actually the two exercises are usually quite aligned and quite complementary. I could talk about how it might continue to evolve, but I should stop there.
All right. Shah, if I can bring you into the conversation. So representing Saturna, you are an asset manager, you develop new products. What are the criteria that you guys take into consideration when engineering new products, Islamic ESG products? And really, in your opinion, do you think we have successfully merged Islamic and ESG when it comes to product development?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh, and a very good day to everyone here. Thank you for the questions. Okay, I think the most important criteria to have a Sharia sustainable products would be incorporating the ESG criteria inside the Sharia investment process itself. Okay, I just want to go going through the process. Okay, otherwise you will not call it Sharia ESG products. Yeah, so you have to do the negative screening of the of your portfolio or your investment universe to actually avoid fundamentally unsound companies and highly leveraged companies that are involved in haram activities. And when we're talking about ESG filter, we are using the ESG data here to actually look for companies that are has strong values and they are also positively social and environmental impact. And we want to come up with a portfolio that is good, high-quality companies that are resilient, which are positively reduce the risk and also identify opportunities for the business. So in this manner, it allow us to actually come up with a portfolio for the investors of a high quality companies as well as producing wealth or a company that is sustainable. And that is the step if you want to go through the filtering of the investment process. Now, and have we actually covered on all the products that we want that is aligned with the Sharia's and ESG investing? I think there's a lot of work to be done, especially in a developing market. There's a lot to look into. Okay, coming, you have to have more Sharia ESG fund managers, and you want to have more Sharia ESG funds on the platform. And at the same time, we are looking at having more products in the market. We want to explore products like probably ETF, Sharia ESG ETF. We want to have an index that is Sharia ESG index. We want to look at development of global suku, SRI link suku. And on a smaller scale, we want to look at something which we can fractionalize the price of our investment product. I mean the NAV investment product. So that a lot of clients who wants to invest regularly, but they want it at a small price. It will probably come back to R1 or it can be even 10 cents, okay? So these are something we want to look at this we have to go into financial inclusion as well. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. When we talk about ESG, there's a lot of talk about, for example, energy security, food security, energy transition. How do you see these, how have they influenced the sustainable investment landscape?
Sure. So it's a very relevant question, actually. And as the fellow panelists have discussed, the evolution of ESG investing, how it has basically started for ESG tilting or exclusion. But as you rightly mentioned, for example, in Asia, more than half of the electricity is generated via fossil fuel, specifically coal. And if you look at any index, especially any Paris-aligned or climate transition indices, which is targeting net zero, they recommend phasing out of coal. So they will not have any exposure to coal, for example, in the portfolio, which is basically totally against what you see in a big region like Asia Pacific. And hence, what we see, especially in this region, a general discussion about not just either green or brown sector, but you have something called a transition sector, which basically helps in transitioning from a very brown area where you are using a lot of coal for electricity production to cleaner areas. This will basically not stop the funding to the coal companies immediately, but it will kind of incentivize them to invest into the projects which will be less coal sensitive in the future. So this is just about the coal part. But you mentioned about other aspects as well. And it's worth highlighting that there are recommendations on T TNFD side, so Task Force on Nature-Related Biodiversity or ecosystem kind of thing. 5 years back, TCFD was in everybody's mind, and nobody thought that it would be such a game changer. But now you look at that, almost every major investor all around the world, they are net zero targeting, and even ISSB guidelines have incorporated TCFD. Why TNFD is important, specifically for Malaysia? So Malaysia is one of the key biodiversity area in ASEAN, okay? And it has many biodiversity hotspots. Even many Malaysians believe that we have to preserve this, and under TNFD guidelines, we have to maintain at least 30% of this to maintain the sustainable ecosystem in future. And just what we saw in case of TCFD, I'm sure that 5 years down the line, we'll see something on TNFD as well. So there'll be a big investment globally on biodiversity, on ecosystem in general. That is the second point. And the last one that I will highlight quickly, and what we are seeing in globally in Asia Pacific as well, is increasing focus on UN Sustainable Development Goals, so SDGs. There are many investors who want to do impact investing on various, 17 of them, or probably few of them, depending upon their criteria. So we see evolution not just from the plain ESG or net zero kind of perspective, but moving towards transition finance, towards biodiversity preservation, and towards meeting the Sustainable Development Goals. So thank you.
So you talk about TCFD, but on a pragmatic level, practically, how do asset owners, asset managers, how can they implement, say, like TCFD's recommendations?
So that's, again, very good question. So what we are seeing that earlier, the focus was just on looking at those companies which are having a progressive pathways toward decarbonization and phasing out the companies which are basically not aligned to a scenario which is 1.5 degrees, okay? So very much depending upon what history look like. So it's easy to phase out an oil and gas company, for example, right? But now we have more and more data availability, and there are many data providers. We are one of them, actually. But we can, using those data, we can foresee which companies are aligned to 1.5 scenario by 2050. And given that more and more data is available, asset owners, regulators, asset managers, they can all look under the hood, and they just do not rely on fossil fuel companies, but they can look at, let's say, technology companies. What are they doing? Or other sectors, what they can do to promote a cleaner environment or 1.5 scenario. So availability of data is one of the key issues which is helping asset owners, regulators, all kind of financial players in meeting net zero targets. Thank you.
Yes, what you're indicating, what you're painting is that, yes, the availability of data is more now. I mean, we're getting more and more data every day. But also the lack of availability of data is also a real challenge, as we discussed earlier. So, Shaham, my question to you now, you know, as an asset manager, how do you collect and how do you reconcile or address this issue of limited data universe?
Okay, first, I think... First, you have to have analytical capabilities, right? And we have to have these ESG sets of data from the Islamic investors, from the investees. With this, then we can create an expansion of the market. And then you can analyze the data. And with this, we want to move. We want to encourage companies to actually disclose their ESG targets that is in line with the SDG goals. So this is not easy to do. More than often, companies do not actually report it in their ESG disclosure, and what they do is just they just mention it. Okay, I want to we want to just reduce poverty. That's all. Full stop. Okay. So you have to go one more steps. You have to tell what's your objective. Okay. How much have you achieved? So with that data, then you can move one more ahead, where you will say that okay, you have the quantity and you can qualify it. Okay, so we just don't take data like, oh, okay, I want to reduce poverty. No, we don't take that. So we have to encourage corporates to actually disclose their ESG goals and target aligning with the SDG goals, right? And that is very important in data collection. And if you want, that's one step. But the other one is you have to develop, you have to come up with, I call these bodies that actually certify companies that are Sharia and also ESG compliant. You have to have that bodies available. Otherwise, you cannot come up with all this data. And at the same time, example like Bursa Malaysia in 2021 came up with the FTSE for Good Sharia Index. So that's helpful. So even though there are not many companies yet in that range, we have about, I think, less than 50 or about 50 to 60 range. But that's important because when you have data, when you analyze this data, so, I mean, I won't go into the analyzation of the data, which we do, after analyzing those data, we actually use other third party like Sustainalytics, Bloomberg, to actually gauge our risk, the assets that we're holding. So in that sense, we are just using it for benchmarking and comparison when we have that data. And then the fund manager will actually come up with a report, a really extensive report on the ESG quality of that company. And we actually give them a rating from A to F. We only invest in A and B categories. That's all. And that's how we analyze the data. Thank you.
So if I may add one point, So yeah, that's a very good point that you mentioned. And fundamentally speaking, if you are an ESG-focused investor, data is everything. If your data is wrong, it will not achieve the required objective. That's totally correct. So for example, under TCFD guidelines, they ask investors to invest into those companies which are not only, you know, addressing, let's say, transition risk in terms of decarbonization, but physical risk as well. And by measuring physical risk is not an easy job. You have to understand where all the assets are lying globally. And you have to model different heat wave conditions, sea level rises, and all those conditions to stress test the performance of those assets. So for example, S&P True Cost Data, it is basically market leader in this region too. And our indices are based on these data sets, which basically help investors to decide how the scenario looks like in the future. But yeah, you're totally right. Data is the key for a ESG investment. Thank you.
I think it becomes even more difficult in the context of measuring social impact as well. So the environmental impact, you can get that quantitative data, whereas with social impact, there are so many different variables that are almost qualitative as well. So as you say, sort of alleviating poverty, what does that mean, and how do you measure that in this particular sort of area? So yeah, that becomes even more difficult.
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely. Like, disclosure is so important, but also you're mentioning how do we measure impact, right? And in the end, like, how can we improve on something we cannot measure, I think is a key question as well. So Elias, I just want to leverage on your expertise because you cover Southeast Asia market, but also the GCC or the Middle East market. So in your have you observed what markets in any of these regions have has successfully demonstrated that they can provide good, robust regulatory frameworks, policies to nurture and to promote Islamic sustainable finance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there have definitely been very encouraging developments in a number of jurisdictions, particularly in Islamic finance hubs like Malaysia and the GCC as well. So there have been a range of different taxonomies developed, for example, across those jurisdictions. Regulators have put in place frameworks that encourage, sometimes sort of prescribe for reporting standards to be adhered to, data collection as well, transparency, investor protections. So there's definitely been a lot of encouraging developments in those jurisdictions. And actually, I think this was a point being made on the panel yesterday, at the IFN event yesterday, that I was moderating, that often these taxonomies, these frameworks, are actually structure agnostic. So they would apply equally to conventional and Sharia compliant investments. And as I sort of touched upon earlier, when you look at the ethical screening involved in Sharia compliant investments, the values that you're applying to that particular investment, the screening process that you're applying, almost naturally, effectively, or in fact naturally aligns with the various taxonomies and the various frameworks that are put in place in these different jurisdictions. So, we're seeing very positive developments, but I think there's still quite a lot of work to be done. So, in fact, actually, the proliferation of different taxonomies has in itself created an issue. So this created mismatches in various jurisdictions in terms of what is a Sharia-compliant investment in one jurisdiction may not be in the other. That actually sometimes leads to greenwashing, either inadvertent greenwashing or, you know, effectively greenwashing arbitrage, green arbitrage, effectively, which undermines faith in the market generally, and you know, something that needs to be addressed. Also, as I think as we move towards a more sort of global Islamic financial system, it would be great to see the harmonization of standards, both in terms of the Sharia compliance aspects of the products, but also in terms of the ESG compliance aspects of those products.
I just want to quickly circle back on what we talked just earlier about data and also measuring impact, right? So, of course, S&P is a data provider. Curious to know, how then do you develop like the methodologies, or how can we effectively, properly, accurately monitor and measure and essentially report this data set or progress the impact of such projects?
There are two fundamental aspects of having a robust data. So first of all, it is good that if data is collected from a publicly available information. And second, if you do not have publicly available data, then you can go and ask the company directly on what do they think about different aspects of E, S, or G, for example, right? If you do not have these options, then of course you go for modeling. But modeling, as you can guess, is prone to all kind of errors. So from our side, as you rightly pointed out, we conduct something called corporate sustainability assessment. And under this, we send thousands of questions to more than 15,000 companies globally on all this E, S, and G topics. And we rely on their answers. And then we cross-check them, look at how they are comparing to industry peers. And based upon that, we create our ESG score. And this is the only kind on the street. Everybody else is either using purely publicly available data, and if it is not, then they will model themselves. So this will basically create some sort of, I would say, misalignment. And that's why you will probably hear on media that ESG scores are not 100% correlated across all ESG data providers. So unfortunately, there's not a clear-cut angle from the regulatory agencies on how it should be done, although the discussions are happening in various jurisdictions to align how ESG scores are calculated. But yeah, if you look at the waterfall model and how it should be done, you should go for the public information, of course. And then if you do not have, then just rely on what the company actually are providing. So that's how we maintain and provide robustness to the data. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the floor? Okay. Elias, we heard from the previous sessions, obviously, one of the issues is greenwashing, social washing, da-da-da. Do you think, well, I suppose you would say that this is probably a concern, and what kind of work do we need to do to address such concerns?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. And this, again, this is something that we've been discussing quite a bit over the last few days, potentially months, years. I was sharing a panel yesterday with Mushtaq from ICMA, International Capital Markets Association, who summarized it succinctly in terms of the sort of types of greenwashing. One, there's just blatant misrepresentation. So effectively, he noted it was securities fraud. You're just lying about the product. The second is almost sort of inadvertent greenwashing, where you've made a claim about a product using vague terms that can be misinterpreted. And so that results in a certain perception of the product that doesn't turn out to be true. And then the third is where you haven't actually done anything wrong. You've complied with your regulatory requirements, you've applied the relevant taxonomy applicable in your jurisdiction or your sector, but that differs from what a third party might be applying. So from their perspective, you've labeled a product green that isn't, from their perspective, green. And that's just because of the different taxonomies that we sort of discussed earlier. So I think there is quite a bit of work to address these three different types of greenwashing. I think the first is the development of more robust regulatory frameworks, potentially. But of course, you then have to balance out the regulatory framework with freedom of market participants and innovation. So there is obviously that tension that regulators constantly face. Increased reporting, which is there, but now there are complaints around there's almost too much in terms of disclosure requirements being imposed. And that's actually quite onerous for small to medium-sized enterprises. So, for example, I was speaking earlier with some attendees, and there's talk around, or there's mention around Securities Commission working to develop less onerous reporting, or streamlined, I should say, reporting requirements when it comes to ESG disclosure for small and medium-sized enterprises, to allow them to participate more meaningfully in applying these standards to their businesses and reporting on them, which I think it would, frankly, be a very welcome development for the industry and will help the ecosystem develop. Then I think there is a degree of education and awareness. I was speaking with Bashir yesterday from the DIFC, and you know he was bemoaning, rightfully so, the degree, you know, the fact that there needs to be more human capital. We see more time, more investment made into raising awareness. And he then praised IFN and Securities Commission for putting together events like this. So I thought that would be a good plug as well. But definitely, I think sort of the fact that you're having conversations, the fact that we are sort of working to raise awareness is definitely a very positive and welcomed development. I think helps address the solution, helps to be a part of the solution.
I can also get your perspective on this.
So all valid points. And the important thing is this is not just limited to, let's say, emerging markets or Asian economies, but you see it happening all over the world. So, for example, there are many regulatory fines that happened, for example, in Australia a few months back. And very well-known asset managers were fined by regulators on the charges of greenwashing. And as it was directly mentioned, they were using some other benchmark, and the way the benchmark was created was not appropriately mentioned in the fund brochure. And then it basically gave the impression to investors that it is doing what it is not actually doing. And so, rightly said, we need much more clarity from the regulatory side. For example, in Europe, you might have heard as well, Article 8 and Article 9 funds. And so Paris-aligned indices or Paris-aligned funds, they invest in all kind of sectors, but they do not have a clear-cut guidelines that you have to have X percentage of amount in sustainable investment. While Article 9 funds under European regulation says that you have to have certain amount of investment into sustainable investment to be qualified as Article 9. So now this is a very big conundrum for investors. On the one hand, you have a Paris-aligned fund, which is net zero targeted. Regulators came with this idea of creating a Paris-aligned benchmark. On the other hand, there's no clarity whether it is an Article 9 fund or not. So these kind of confusion not only exists in, I guess, a smaller market or developing market, but even the markets where the sustainable investment revolution started. So basically, all the parties, especially regulators, need to be clear on their messaging and how it should be approached. Yeah.
So this means of like confusion or, I suppose, lack of a clear messaging, vague messaging, right? Then how are large institutional investors approaching this?
That's a very good question. So when this confusion started, you might have heard that a lot of institutional investors, they downgraded their fund from Article 9 to Article 8 because they were worried that they will get a regulatory penalty. They will get the bad name in terms of greenwashing. So unfortunately, the fund managers have to play conservatively at the moment. But if we have to achieve meaningful targets or we have to move money into sustainable investment, there has to be courageous talks, I would say, and clear guidelines from regulators and from parties involved. Yeah. Thank
you. Final check. Any questions? Question?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
1 minute.
Afternoon. Okay, I'm looking at the title, Blueprint and Protecting the Future. Protecting the Future here refers specifically to ESG, right? Now, my question is addressed to Puan Shaharia. Now, how do you look in terms of Islamic sustainable and social investing with respect to ESG? Is it a subset or it is a superset of what we define as ESG here? Because there's always these issues, you know, if it's a subset, then it's inadequate. Then Islamic finance may have to buck up or, you know, put in more criteria to comply with ESG standards. Thank you.
Okay. To begin with, I think there's close ties between Islamic investment and the ESG investment. There are many parallels to this, both concept. So, and we know that it has also very close ties to the Quran and the Hadith and the ESG factors itself. So, example would be if you were looking at water management, it's mentioned in the Quran, in the Hadith. And if you go into the Sirah literature, it says that the Islamic investors should look into the social issues like labor practices, animal cruelty. And in Islam, the business models is clearly, the business ethics models are already there. So these are the key components of the corporate governance. So both of them are actually, they have many parallels, and this integrates the two systems. The Sharia system and the ESG system. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, so we do have a few more minutes left. I want to essentially wrap up the session. And I want to have every panelist here, you know, like we've been speaking at events year in, year out, right? So if we come back again next year, we convene again next year, what would you like to see changed or achieved? And maybe, perhaps you can also share, like, you know, from your institution point of view, like, what are you guys actually doing in order to move, you know, the agenda forward? I mean, maybe I can start with you and go down.
Sure. So, as we have been discussing throughout this session, a lot of discussion was on climate change, the movement of funds into the areas which basically support or help fight against climate change. And earlier it was very much focused in Europe or even in developed markets in Asia. But what we are seeing progressively now, that more and more countries' jurisdiction are formulating rules, incentivizing funds to invest into these products. And what I would like to see that 1 year down the line, there's more and more investment in Malaysia specifically. So yeah, that's my wish. Thank you.
How ambitious can we be in our wishes? World
Dream
peace.
Big.
Yeah, exactly. I think from my perspective, I'd like to see a greater degree of standardization in terms of, I know it's a boring answer. I saw you wince. I'm a lawyer. I've got it. So, yeah, I definitely would like to see a greater degree of standardization of taxonomies. I'd like to see a standardization across the global Islamic finance industry when it comes to applying those, the manner in which they're applied, and also a standardization. I know this is something that's been said for decades, of Sharia principles. I think having a more standardized set of Sharia principles from a global perspective increases the investor pool, reduces inefficiencies, brings down lawyers' fees, so I shouldn't be saying that. And so, yeah, it has a lot of benefits. So.
Sure. Okay. I think, to me, the ESG data is very important. I would like to have it available on the public platform where the banks, the institutions, the insurance companies, the government bodies can get this data available easily. So then we can address the issue of climate change better. And as example, if you're a bank, you need the data to actually understand what your clients needs. Okay, let's say the clients wants to have more loans on EV products, on EV cars, then you can, you are ready for a loan that is for an EV product. So as long as there's more data available, and we can come up with more products, innovative products in the market. Thank you.
And I think for me, I will have a key takeaway as well. You know, just from listening for all the sessions today, including what you guys have shared, is that the sector is evolving, right? And I don't use that word lightly. It is evolving, and we are trying to keep up. I think we're all still trying to learn and figure out what to do, essentially. And mistakes will be made. I think what's most important is that we need to adapt, learn from our mistakes, and put in, you know, best foot forward, and make sure we have the right frameworks, the right policies, the right intentions. To hopefully, you know, channel finance for social good, environmental good. And 1:30 on the dot, as I promised. So please, everyone, please help me thank our panelists for the wonderful session. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.